So where is your hope? Where is your hope? In the mid-1800s, a Scottish missionary named John Patton sailed with his new wife to a chain of islands in the South Pacific, now known as Vanuatu. And at that time, the inhabitants of these islands were cannibals. Indeed, the only previous missionaries to these islands had been killed, cooked, and eaten just hours after their arrival. But Patton and his wife went. And during his initial years on this first island, Patton's wife died in childbirth. The infant son lived, but died only a few weeks later. And Patton's life was in constant danger. After 4 years, there was only a handful of converts who believed in Jesus, and he was quite discouraged. And one night, he got word that a mob was coming with the intention to kill him, and so he fled his home. He didn't know where to go, and a man came up beside him and guided him and said, took him to a tree and said, "Climb this tree and you'll be safe here." But Patton had no idea if this guy was planning to betray him, trying to get him to stay in one place, and then he was going to direct the mob to the tree and they would kill him in the tree. But he climbed up and he waited and he waited. There was nothing that he could do at that point. He was completely at the end of his resources, sitting in the tree, hearing muskets firing, hearing yelling and screaming. How would you feel in such a situation? Would you have any hope? If so, why? We've been making our way through the book of Isaiah, and we've come to chapter 41. A number of you have memorized chapter 41, verse 10, that we've already referred to a couple of times in this service. "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." So God commands us, whatever our circumstances, fear not. And yet we fear, don't we? Consider particularly the fear that so often accompanies our considering speaking the gospel. Oftentimes we're tempted not to witness to the grace of God because we fear being looked down upon, or we fear being rejected by friends and family, or we fear a loss of status. And yes, when we go out to some places, we fear death, or we fear years of fruitless service in a dangerous and difficult place. So what does this passage tell us in order to comfort those fears? Well, chapter 41 is part of the same literary unit as chapter 40, which we looked at last week. Remember, chapter 40 begins with these words, "Comfort, comfort my people." We summarized the main points of chapter 40 last week, saying, the first main point, behold the God who plans for his people's comfort. And then, behold the greatness of your creating God. And thirdly, behold the promise of the almighty creating God. We emphasized in those main points that God is not only creator, but he is creating. He is continuing his process of creating. He is actively involved. He's not someone who just set things in motion thousands or millions of years ago and then stepped back, but he continues his intimate involvement with all the details of our lives. And that passage last week also emphasizes the greatness of God's power and the scrawny nature of human power. And yet this God who is so great also is tender towards the weakest of his people. And he empowers his people so that they might become what he intends them to be. Chapter 40 ends with this image of God empowering his people. Remember? I'm going to read these last five verses of chapter 40 because you'll see that they flow right into chapter 41. So if you have your Bibles, open up to chapter 40. Again, these are well-known verses. Some of you have memorized all of them. Chapter 40, verse 27. And think of John Patton in the tree, tempted to fear. "Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my right is disregarded by my God? Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary, and his understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted, but they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." Well, we find this same idea in chapter 41 with a bit of a shift in emphasis. We find that God comforts his people because of three aspects of his character. First, God is ruler of this world. God is, second, the one who empowers his people. And then one particular way that he empowers his people is by being their redeemer. So we're going to make our way straight through chapter 41 this morning rather than going at it topically. And so our outline won't be that thematic outline, but instead one that will look initially at the first seven verses under the title, "An Invitation from the Ruling God to All Peoples." An invitation from the ruling God to all peoples. And then verses 8 to 10 under the title, "Comfort from the Ruling God's Promise to His People." Comfort from the Ruling God's Promise to His People. And then the third heading, verses 11 to 20, three pictures of God's help for his people. Three pictures of God's help for his people. But first of all, an invitation from the ruling God to all peoples, verses 1 to 7. Now, as we've seen throughout the book of Isaiah, the prophet addresses both Jews and the nations, all peoples. And one section of the book will focus on one group, another section on the other group, but Isaiah continues to address not only the people of Israel, but also all nations. And way back in chapter 2, Isaiah had prophesied that all nations shall flow to the mountain of the house of the Lord, and many peoples shall come. So right at the beginning of the book, Isaiah had said, these promises are not only for ethnic Israel, but for all nations. And back in chapter 40, last week, we saw that he said in verse 5, the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. All flesh, another way to say, all nations, all the peoples. Well, Isaiah continues this emphasis on the peoples in chapter 41, verse 1. Listen to me in silence, O coastlands. Isaiah has used this word meaning coastlands or islands elsewhere to refer to peoples and nations. Let the peoples renew their strength. Let them approach, then let them speak. Let us together draw near for judgment. This is a courtroom scene. God is inviting, indeed commanding, all the nations to come before him to settle a question. He says, let us draw near together for judgment. But remember, the Hebrew word translated judgment has a broader meaning than our word judgment. Don't think of this as condemnation. This is not a throne at the end of time where God is going to assign people to hell. But rather, he's drawing the nations to come to him to settle a question, settle a question of truth. As the next verses show, the question is, who is God? Who is God? And then note the phrase, the second phrase, let the peoples renew their strength. Remember that phrase? We just read it in verse 31 of chapter 40. Those who wait for the Lord will renew their strength. Okay? Well, what does that imply? He's just said, why, O Israel, do you complain? Those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. And now he's inviting all nations to renew their strength. He's offering to the nations the same promise that he's just given to the scattered Israelites. So this is an invitation to all peoples. He's saying the message of chapter 40 is not only to ethnic Israel, but also for all of you nations. You must understand who I am and respond to who I am. Respond with trust. Respond with faith. Respond by waiting for me. Those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. Well, let's keep reading in verses 2 to 4. I'm going to read mainly in ESV, but verse 2 I'm going to read in the New Living Translation because I think it brings out the message more clearly. It's kind of complicated Hebrew, and I think New Living Translation hits it just right. So verse 2, New Living, and then into ESV. Who has stirred up this king from the east, rightly calling him to God's service? Who gives this man victory over many nations and permits him to trample their kings underfoot? He pursues them and passes on safely by paths his feet have not trod. Who has performed and done this, calling the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, the first and with the last, I am he. Well, Isaiah brings here a picture of a king coming and conquering other nations. The identity of the king is not given, and it's not really important. It could be Assyria that we've already read about coming and trying to conquer Jerusalem. Could be Babylon, which Isaiah has prophesied will conquer Jerusalem later. It could be the Persian king Cyrus, who will conquer Babylon, and Isaiah will speak directly about him in a few chapters. But it could be any conquering country, even today. The question is, who allows this to happen? Who raises up a king and empowers this king to be able to conquer other nations? Isaiah's point is not, who is this king? The point is, who stirs up the king? Who called him? And then he has an interesting word here in the New Living, to God's service. Who calls this unbelieving, idol-worshipping king into the service of God? Who empowered him to go places he could never even walk himself? And the answer is Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. God himself stirred up this king. He is the first, that is, he is before all things, and he is with the last, an interesting phrase. Elsewhere, God says, I am the first, I'm the last, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. But here he says, I am with the last. What's he emphasizing there? I am the first. Before me, there's nothing. But at the end of time, my people are going to be with me. I'm with the last. If you are mine, you will be with me forever and ever. He will be with those that he calls to himself. He will be with those whose strength he renews. He will be with those who mount up on wings like eagles. So God says to the peoples, I'm in charge of all events in this world. No king conquers without me. And I empower one nation over against another. I always have, and I always will. Will you acknowledge this and wait for me? Asks God. If so, I will empower you too. You too can renew your strength. You can keep putting on fresh strength. Well, how will the people respond? Verses 5 to 7 give the answer that most of the peoples give to God. In verse 5, they begin rightly by trembling in fear. The coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near and come. But then Isaiah pictures two wrong responses. Verse 6, everyone helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. Now that might sound positive to us, but in the context of what Isaiah is saying here, it is negative. When God has invited the peoples to put on fresh strength from him, it is wrong to say, you have enough strength inside you to be strong. So usher up that strength from in you and be strong. That's imagining that they can have strength apart from God. God is saying, depend on me. Let me be your strength. But these people are exalting human strength above God's power. And then, when the people realize that human strength is insufficient, what do they do? Verse 7, the craftsman strengthens the goldsmith, and he who smooths with the hammer, him who strikes the anvil, saying of the soldering, it's good. And they strengthen it with nails so that it cannot be moved. What's he talking about? Idolatry. When we first depend on our own inner strength and then find that insufficient, man's temptation again and again and again is to reach out for some idol, something to give him strength but which he can control. A false god, a genie. Well, these are two temptations we face today, aren't they? When we're faced with desperate circumstances, we are tempted to respond with our own self-sufficiency. Just like the children's book, right? About the little train that had a hard time getting to the top of the hill. And how did he get to the top of the hill? I think I can. You know, self-sufficient, inner resources. Draw on that inner power you didn't think you had. Well, that's nonsense. God is the only one who can give us the power we need to accomplish what he plans for us. And then the second temptation we face is to turn to any other power, whether it's another human, whether it's another religion, another god, some idol that we look to. We face the same temptations today. He is the first, he is with the last. He rules all events, and he invites all people to come to him. So don't let us turn elsewhere, either inside or outside, for strength. Second main heading, comfort from the ruling God's promise to his people. We see this in verse 8 to 10. This is the center of this passage, the main point that Isaiah is making. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest corner, saying to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you off. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. So we've seen God send out his invitation to all the peoples, and then the people reject him. And now God turns to his chosen people. Who are these chosen people? They're described here simply as those whom I have chosen, whom I took from the ends of the earth, whom I called from its farthest corners. Now remember last week we said that this section of Isaiah, beginning in chapter 40, Isaiah projects himself forward and speaks particularly to the exiles from destroyed Jerusalem. He's projecting himself more than 100 years forward in this. And so the people of Israel, ethnic Israel, is scattered, and God promises to gather them and bring them back, which he does. But this is also consistent with the image we've already seen of God's invitation to all the nations. So yes, the people of Israel are scattered over, but that in and of itself is a picture of God's chosen people dwelling in the midst of every people on this earth. So that God has those that he has elected to himself in every people group, and he promises to gather them together regardless of their nationality. And I think that's the way to understand this in light of the invitation that just went out, in light of the earlier passages such as Isaiah 2 that I referred to earlier. So God is speaking, therefore, to us, whether we have Jewish ancestry or not. He is speaking to us, those who are Indonesian by birth, those who have British ancestry, or Scottish ancestry, or Germanic ancestry, or African ancestry. God is speaking to all nations. Because all of us, as Paul says in the book of Romans, those from every tribe and tongue and nation will be grafted into the olive tree, that is the people of Israel, and be God's chosen people. So God comforts all of his people of all nationalities with these words, fear not. Why shouldn't we fear? Does he tell us, fear not, because you really have those inner resources and you just need to tap into them? No, that's not what he says, is it? Fear not, why? Because I am with you. The ruling God is right beside you. The one who stirs up kings and brings them to conquer, he is right beside you. I am your God, he says, so look nowhere else for comfort or power. And so he asks, are you weak and unable to meet the forces coming against you? Fear not, for I will strengthen you. Do you need an ally to come to your aid to fight your battles? I will help you. I will be your ally, he says. Are you weary and fainting and falling exhausted? I'll carry you. I'll uphold you. I'll uphold you with the right hand of my righteousness. I will enable you to accomplish all I desire for my glory. Comfort from the ruling God's promise to his people. Well, let's move to the third heading. Three pictures of God's help for his people. We see these three pictures in verses 11 to 20. Here, Isaiah elaborates on his message of comfort. First picture, verses 11 to 13, I title this, I will make your enemies as nothing. I will make your enemies as nothing. Note two times in these verses, God says that their enemies will be nothing. Verses 11 to 13. Behold, all who are incensed against you shall be put to shame and confounded. Those who strive against you shall be as nothing and shall perish. You shall seek those who contend with you, but you shall not find them. Those who war against you shall be as nothing at all. For I, the Lord your God, hold your right hand. It is I who say to you, fear not, I am the one who helps you. So all these enemies that look so powerful, so mighty, disappear. This is really an amusing picture, as the second one is amusing also. You have this big army against you, then you go out, where are they? I thought we were going to fight. They've just gone. And remember, that's exactly what God did to the Assyrians back in chapter 36 and 37. 180,000 just killed in one night. They disappeared. Why should we have this confidence? Because, he says, I, Yahweh, the Lord, am your God, and I hold your right hand. Okay, remember he just said, I will uphold you with the right hand of my righteousness. And when my right hand grabs your right hand, then you have all the power you need. Then you are upheld. So fear not, you have an ally, the Lord God himself. Now what does this mean? This is where we make mistakes oftentimes. It's particularly where the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel goes astray. God is not saying you will never suffer at the hands of other humans. He's not saying you will never suffer at the hand of Satan. He's not saying you will accomplish everything you want to accomplish when you go out for my glory. What is he saying? He's saying, if particularly, we just think back at the earlier chapters. In 36 and 37, God rescues Jerusalem from the attacking Assyrian army, right? But what about the city of Lachish? There were faithful Jews in the city of Lachish. And yet the Assyrians conquered that and destroyed the city. So right in the very context of this chapter, we have people of God who were overwhelmed by enemy forces. What is God promising here? What is God promising? Not that his people would never be taken into exile. Isaiah has already prophesied that that's going to happen. What he's promising is there will be no ultimate harm to my people. I am ruler, says God. I will superintend all that happens for the good of my people and the glory of my name. There are no mistakes. There are no accidents. I never say oops. If you suffer, it is for a purpose. And you will receive 100 times more in this life and in the life to come, eternal life, eternal pleasures at my right hand. There is no ultimate sacrifice. Now, there are short-term sacrifices to taking up your cross daily and following him. That's the first picture. I will make your enemies as nothing. Second picture, verses 14 to 16. I entitled this, I will strengthen you to overcome to your joy and my glory. I will strengthen you to overcome to your joy and my glory. This is a very interesting section. God here pictures his people as a worm. That's not a very flattering picture, is it? I've never really aspired to be an earthworm. But that's God's picture for his people here. But notice what the worm becomes and what the worm does. Fear not, you worm, Jacob, you men of Israel. I am the one who helps you, declares the Lord. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I make of you a threshing sledge, new, sharp, and having teeth. You shall thresh the mountains and crush them. You shall make the hills like chaff. You shall winnow them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the tempest shall scatter them. And you shall rejoice in the Lord, in the Holy One of Israel, you shall glory. Before we look at the image here, I want to pick up on the word Redeemer. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. This becomes a major theme of the rest of the book. The root for redeem, in either its noun or verb form, has appeared only three times previously in the book of Isaiah. Remember back in chapter 35, it says, the redeemed of the Lord shall return and come with singing to Zion. That's one of the three places. But from here, chapter 41, to the end of the book, 23 times the word redeemer or the verb redeem appears. And so this becomes a very important theme for the rest of the book. This is the first time in this section it's been introduced. Let me just remind you of what this means. Our normal image of redemption is of like a pawn shop. So I go and I put my watch in the pawn shop and the shop owner gives me money. And if I have enough money, I can go back and pay him more than he gave me and he'll give me the watch back, right? And so I can redeem my watch that I had to give away. A price was necessary. And that's an important element. But to the Jews, there was another yet more important element. Remember the story of Ruth. How Ruth returns from Moab, and there's two men in the story who are her kinsmen redeemers, okay, for Naomi, Naomi's kinsmen redeemers. And so Boaz ends up taking Ruth as his wife, providing for all of her needs in the name of her dead husband, Elimelech. Okay. And so that idea of being a kinsman redeemer is one who takes as his own the redeemed one and provides for every need of that redeemed person. So it's much more personal than the pawn shop image. It includes that idea of paying the price to get the person out of slavery or out of whatever binds them, but also there's a provision element in this Israelite picture of the kinsman redeemer. And so that's what God is saying he will do for us. It is a picture of giving power, but it's also a picture of giving love and care, providing for every possible need. Your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Okay, now let's look at this other image here. The worm and the threshing sledge. I'm not going to get into what the threshing sledge is because almost none of you grew up on farms, and it's going to take too long to try to describe what this is to you. But let me focus on the worm and the power here. The main point is simple, and it's supposed to be amusing, okay? And so it's as if God gave a command to a worm and said, worm, I want you to go and level that mountain. And the worm says, well, I'm good at digging, so I'm going to go. And I'll start digging at this mountain. And so the worm works all day, and after one day has moved 1 ounce of dirt. Right? And after 2 days, 2 ounces of dirt. And after a year, you know, a few pounds of dirt. And the worm is never going to move this mountain. The worm has no ability to move the mountain in and of its own power. But God says, I will take you, my people, my worm, and make this worm into a mighty, powerful piece of earth-moving equipment so that my people, wormy people, are able now to level this mountain. That's what he's saying. We're like worms, we together, only one worm, working at this mountain. But God says, by my power, you will level the mountain. So God promises his power to accomplish whatever he commands his people. And note the last sentence in verse 16. You shall rejoice in the Lord. In the Holy One of Israel, you shall glory. So when you, his people, level that mountain, where's your joy? It's not in saying, wow, we did it. But it's in saying, what a God. What a God. What a God who saves one of the Aji people after 2,000 years. We don't say, I'm such a great worm. So he is our joy, and all glory goes to him. So, first picture, enemies become nothing. Second picture, weak people, the worm, accomplish great things according to God's plan. Final picture, verses 17 to 20, I entitle this, I will provide for your needs so that you know my power. I will provide for your needs so that you know my power. Let me read these verses. When the poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will put in the wilderness the cedar, the acacia, the myrtle, and the olive. I will set in the desert the cypress, the plane, and the pine together, that they may see and know, and may consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. Well, this is a very simple picture. The people are in the desert. They've run out of water. They look all around. No oasis anywhere to be found. The sun is beating down on them. It's hot. Their tongue is parched. They're going to die without water, without shade. And God says, when you're that desperate, I'll provide for you. I'll provide water where there is none. I'll provide shade trees where nothing would grow. Why? Why does God do this? Well, the previous pictures emphasized that we might accomplish God's purposes. This picture doesn't emphasize that. Look at that last verse again. That they may see and know, may consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. That's why. That's why. That they may understand who I am. That they may trust me above all things. God provides when we are desperate so that we might understand and know him and trust him. Well, those are the three pictures that we have at the end of this passage. Well, earlier in the sermon, we left John Patton alone in the tree, wondering if he was to be betrayed. Patton writes, I heard the frequent discharging of muskets and the yells of the savages. Yet I sat there among the branches as safe in the arms of Jesus. Never in all my sorrows did my Lord draw nearer to me and speak more soothingly in my soul as I told all my heart to Jesus, alone and yet not alone. If it be to glorify my God, I will not grudge to spend many nights alone in such a tree, to feel again my Savior's spiritual presence, to enjoy his consoling, comforting fellowship. Was Patton comforted? Yes, greatly comforted. While he sat in the tree, did God tell him, "You are going to be rescued"? No, he didn't. He didn't. That's what I want you to understand. Yes, Patton did not die that night. This is his autobiography. He wrote it. It was later. He got out of the tree. But he was comforted, and he did not fear before he was rescued, before he knew what was happening. Clamor all around him. Cries, musket sounding. Fear not, I am with you. Be not afraid, I am your God. I will strengthen you, I will help you, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Patton knew that Jesus was with him and would remain with him, whatever the outcome. Whether the outcome was death or whether the outcome was escape. Well, Patton, at this point, got off the island. A ship happened to be there that could take him. He got off the island, went back to England, and returned against the advice of a number of people. Went to a different island, and over the course of several years, there was a large people movement on that island. The great majority of the people on the island came to faith, and then some of those people went back to this original island, the island of Tanna, and they were then the vehicles that many of these same people who had persecuted Patton initially came to faith in Jesus Christ. God works that way. God works that way. He works sometimes through his people having great, obvious victories. And he works other times through his people having seemingly obvious defeats. But God rules all and brings about his perfect plan for his glory. Well, Patton concludes this account by asking, if thus thrown back upon your own soul, alone, all alone, in the midnight, in the bush, in the very embrace of death itself, have you a friend that will not fail you then? If you are united with Christ by faith, you do. You do. And you can be united by faith with Christ by believing, as we read from Romans chapter 10, that God created the world for his glory, but man rebelled against that purpose. Instead, choosing to exalt himself and try to be like God himself, and accusing God of having ill purposes and forbidding him from eating the fruit of a tree. And through man's disobedience, all creation was affected. And yet God, in his good purposes, according to his plan, sent his Son in the fullness of time to live the life we all should have lived, loving God with all his heart and soul and mind and strength every minute of every day, and loving every person he encountered as himself, and then choosing voluntarily to die on the cross, paying the penalty that we all deserve. And God then raised him from the dead, showing the penalty paid was sufficient, so that anyone who responds by trusting in him, by confessing with his mouth that Jesus is Lord and believing in his heart that God raised him from the dead, that person will be united with Christ by faith and will be part of his chosen people. It is this gospel that God commands us and empowers us to take to every people on this planet. And it is this gospel that brings good to his people and glory to his name. And we can fulfill his commission to reach every people group with the gospel, whatever the cost. For in the very place he commands us to preach the gospel to all nations, he says, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Fear not, I am with you. Be not afraid, I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. So, fear not. God is with you. Be not dismayed. He is your God. He will indeed strengthen you. He will indeed stand alongside you and be your ally. He will uphold you. So why fear? Step out in faith. Let's pray together.